Okay, I have a hard question for you. Are you ready? Have you ever been standing next to someone who said something that made you concerned about an imminent lightning strike? That's something we joke about. Like, you said what? Let me get out of here. We expect immediate judgment. Or maybe, have you ever wondered why some people are not judged immediately for their sinful actions? That, I think, is a thought that we may have from time to time. Or maybe, have you been glad that you were not immediately judged for some wrong action or thought that you've had? That brings it closer to home. It seems that most of the time, the judgments are rather slow in coming. But there are times when it's rather quick. Like, remember when Uzzah reached out to steady the ark? Gone in a heartbeat. Or Ananias and Sapphira when they lied about the land that they had sold to the Holy Spirit and to God, it says. They both died instantly. Some judgments have an immediately obvious cause and effect. We see something has happened, and then there's an effect that's right there with it. But those occasions are actually fairly rare in Scripture. And we can be thankful that the Lord is more patient most of the time. Patient with us. Sometimes the cause and effect is quite clear and quite close in proximity. And that is the case in the passage that we're going to look at today, though we're only going to see half the story. So you'll have to come back to get the next part in the near future. So we want to think about, what does it take to get God's disfavor? Now, most of us know what it takes to get the disfavor of someone that we live close to. Sometimes it doesn't take much. Some of you can relate. How can you make someone upset? For most of us, it's not too hard. So let's think about the text today. We read in Daniel chapter 5, verse 1, Belshazzar the king made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in the presence of the 1,000. That's just the introductory statement. It doesn't sound particularly problematic. It's kind of just starting in the middle of a story. I mean, at least kind of starting the story out, Belshazzar hadn't been introduced before. So we need to find out some answers to some questions here. But we can see at least one thing as we look at the context. The king exercised his freedom to impress his friends. That's why you have a great feast and you have thousands of your lords come and you drink wine in the presence of the 1,000 so that you can put on some kind of show. So the first thing we need to think about is determining the identity of this king. Who exactly is this? Well, I'll give you a clue. Belshazzar is actually the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. And so you're going to be looking at the text a little bit further down and going, really? That's not what it says. Or does it? He came to power about 9 years after Nebuchadnezzar had died. If you remember, and I don't expect you necessarily will, but Nabopolassar was the first king of the Neo-Babylonian Empire. And his son was Nebuchadnezzar. So Nabopolassar was the father of Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar reigned from 605 to 562 BC. You'll need to write these down because you're not going to keep track of them all. So, and then his son was Evil-Merodach. And he reigned 562 to 560 BC. There's more. He was succeeded by Nergal-Sharezer, who married Nebuchadnezzar's daughter. And so it would have been son-in-law. And he reigned 560 to 556 B.C. And then he was succeeded by his son, Labashi-Marduk, and he reigned for a portion of 556 B.C. Didn't last very long. He was succeeded by Nabonidus, who married Nebuchadnezzar's other daughter and reigned 556 to 539. So you got all that so far? So Nebuchadnezzar had three kids. The first one was a son, then a daughter, and another daughter. And you had the son reigning first, and then the son-in-law, and then another son-in-law. Well, there was actually a son of the first son-in-law, and then another son-in-law, and the son of that son-in-law. And that would have been Belshazzar. He was the son of Nabonidus, who married Nebuchadnezzar's second daughter. And so Belshazzar reigned 553 to 539. Now, if you were writing down those numbers, like I suggested, you would notice that Nabonidus reigned 556 to 539, and Belshazzar reigned 553 to 539. Oh, they overlapped. They were at the same time. Now, the lineage of kings can sometimes be complicated, as here. Belshazzar is the son of Nebuchadnezzar's second daughter, therefore he is the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. He is technically the seventh or the last king of Babylon of this era. Now, if you've been paying attention, we just have heard about another king, not really a king, he was a prince married to the queen of England, Prince Philip, who would likely have been called a king if he had been in the time of the Babylonians. But if you've looked at any of the history of his experience or any of the kings or queens or the rulers of England, Germany, Russia, Greece, and you see all the relationships among them, they are complicated as well. So it's not surprising that this can get a little complicated. So, but we have to come to terms with some terms here in just a little bit. But first of all, I want us to think about the context of these events. So the events of chapter 5 occur much later than the previous chapters of Daniel. So they occurred about 66 years after the events of chapter 1. Again, you really should be writing these down because a lot to remember. And they occurred 36 years after the events of chapter 4. So also, Daniel received the revelation in chapter 7 in the first year of Belshazzar, 553, according to chapter 7, verse 1. And he received the revelation in chapter 8 in Belshazzar's third year, 551 B.C., chapter 8, verse 1. So therefore, chapter 5 follows chapters 7 and 8 chronologically by 14 and 12 years, respectively. And so this would have put Daniel in his 80s at this time. So it's not infrequently the case that the Hebrews had no hesitation to arrange their material topically instead of chronologically, which goes against the grain of obsessive-compulsive people like some of us. And so the reason is to communicate a particular emphasis, and that's what he's doing here. And his particular emphasis here is God's authoritative power over the affairs of the kings and kingdoms of the earth. And so even though this event took place after chapters 7 and 8, he puts it before because it's a continuing idea that he's communicating of another king that God shows his authority over. So interesting things to observe. So the circumstances of Belshazzar's rule are also noteworthy. Now, there are some older critical scholars who claim that Belshazzar was never a king in the Neo-Babylonian Empire. But modern discoveries have shown Belshazzar acted as king during his father's frequent and prolonged absences from Babylon, which explains why they overlapped. If the main guy is going to be gone for a while, then you let somebody else kind of fill in, and that's how it worked. One commentator said this: the last actual Chaldean king, Nabonidus, entrusted the kingship in 539 BC to his son Belshazzar, or Belshazzar, during his 10-year absence from Babylon, returning as the threat from Cyrus grew greater. And, of course, we'll see that that is going to be coming. So we can understand and relate to that basic idea. So even if you look at the kings of Israel, Israel and Judah, in the books of Kings and Chronicles, you'll note that there were times where there were co-regencies as well. Somebody has written a book on that. The name escapes me at the moment, but dealing with the mysterious numbers of the Hebrew kings, I think is the name of the book by Tilley, I think. So anyway, that's not an unusual circumstance in those times. Then the details of this occasion have been questioned by some critics, because they look at the size of this feast and say, well, that seems like there's just too many people there. How could that possibly be? But the ancient historian Ctesias wrote that the Persian kings frequently dined daily with 15,000 people. That is not social distancing. They could get away with that, apparently, at that time. But you look at the Book of Esther, there were also large feast occasions there as well. So it's not surprising, and it's not out of the ordinary from what we read. So we read here that Belshazzar hosted this banquet, and it was on the night that Babylon fell, which we'll see later in this chapter. And so the invading Medes and Persians, led by Ugbaru, the commander of the Persian army, would have already taken control of some of the surrounding countryside. So Belshazzar should have been shaking in his boots instead of partying. He should have been preparing for the inevitable that could be coming toward him. And everyone should have been aware of it. They should have known of the intentions. But Babylon, the city, had not fallen to an invading army for 1,000 years because of its incredibly strong fortifications. According to the ancient Greek historian Herodotus, Babylon occupied about 14 square miles with a double wall system enclosing a moat between the two walls. The outer wall was 87 feet thick, wide enough for four chariots to drive on side by side. So that's pretty good size. The wall was 350 feet high with 100 gates plus hundreds more towers that reached another 100 feet above the walls. So Belshazzar was pretty confident that his capital was secure, so he could party and not worry about it, although he should have been. So he was perhaps missing an opportunity to be better prepared. But also, and there's another element here, his name means Bel, or also known as Marduk, has protected the king. And so he may have had a sense of invincibility or not having to worry about anything because he was protected by his god. And so Herodotus also mentioned that a festival was underway in Babylon when the city fell. So there's other extra-biblical information that confirms these things. So those critics can just go away. they don't have a leg to stand on. But Belshazzar was obviously more concerned about making an impression on his guests, perhaps being a little defiant, maybe a lot defiant, arrogant, maybe a little bit of ignorance, or maybe just a bit deluded, or some sad combination of all three of them. But often pride and arrogance and self-deception go together, so he may have been a victim of that as well. So, continuing on with the text then, Daniel chapter 5, verses 2 through 4, while he tasted the wine, Belshazzar gave the command to bring the gold and silver vessels which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the temple which had been in Jerusalem, that the king and his lords, his wives, and his concubines might drink from them. Then they brought the gold vessels that they had taken from the temple of the house of God, which had been in Jerusalem, and the king and his lords, his wives, and his concubines drank from them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze and iron, wood and stone. So it covers a bit of ground there. So the king used his freedom to disdain Judah's God. Now, there's a word here we need to deal with. He saw in the middle of verse 2, which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the temple which had been in Jerusalem. Well, I thought we just said it was grandfather. So we need to deal with that. The word father was often used of an early ancestor, an earlier ancestor. So Nebuchadnezzar was Belshazzar's grandfather rather than his father. But one commentator points out, neither in Hebrew nor in Chaldee is there any word for grandfather, grandson. So forefathers were called fathers or father's fathers, but a single grandfather or forefather is never called father's father, but always father only. So that was a normal way of reference in those times. So it's helpful to be reminded of that. If you don't have a word for something, you make do with what you do have. And then the matter of the stolen temple vessels, they had been stored as trophies of war. So the presence of the temple vessels in the warehouses of Babylon was seen in the minds of the Babylonians as significant humiliation of Yahweh, who could not prevent their theft. And so that's how it would have been viewed in those days in particular. So using these vessels in the praise of Babylon's gods was even more sacrilegious than just possessing them. It was defiance, to say the least. There's another example of a pagan king setting himself up as superior to Yahweh. I mean, that's been viewed many times in the past. And perhaps Belshazzar was just wanting to strengthen his nationalistic pride among the Babylonians to say, hey, look, we've conquered these people. We can use their vessels and everything's going to be okay. But then there's another indication here as the reference to the Babylonian gods as silver, gold, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. That reflects the Jewish perspective of the writer saying they are nothing. They are just objects that have no reality in the spiritual realm. So for the Israelites, the gods of Belshazzar were not gods at all. But it is interesting to think about the level of sacrilege here that has taken place and the reality that the sacrilege that's taking place in our own time surpasses this exponentially of the things that are going on in our day, in our time, and basically denying every biblical precept and truth imaginable, and it's a very much in-your-face kind of thing. I mean, when you can't even accept the making of mankind, male and female, when that's thrown out and you can't use that terminology, it definitely says something. Talk about calling for divine judgment. That's definitely doing it. So we've gone to the place of dealing with everything from creation to the creation order. Those are thrown out. Dealing with the nature of man. Are we sinful beings or are we basically good? Denial of sin and accountability. There's no God to be accountable to. The sanctity of life, the meaning of life, all of those kinds of things are dealt with in this as well. So if the mere use of some vessels in a sacrilegious way brought or called for divine judgment, it does make us wonder what's going to happen here. And it may make us a little bit nervous and wonder if there's going to be lightning coming down sometime, somewhere. Well, if you've read the book, you know that's going to happen. What does it take to get a leader's attention? Well, let's look at verses 5 and 6. In the same hour, the fingers of a man's hand appeared and wrote opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace, and the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. Then the king's countenance changed, and his thoughts troubled him, so that the joints of his hips were loosened and his knees knocked against each other. That's how you get a leader's attention. That definitely did it. Think about the impact of supernatural activity. Well, we're living in a time and an age where supernatural activity is outright denied. And whether this king wanted to deny it, he had a problem trying to do that. But this event has become a proverbial indication of judgment. We often speak of the handwriting on the wall. That is very familiar. But like his forefather, Belshazzar received an omen from God. God was wanting to get his attention. Nebuchadnezzar had received two special dreams, chapters 1 and chapter 4, and Belshazzar received a special inscription on the wall. And this night of revelry was going to become a night of revelation, where God is making himself known in a very specific way. One commentator, John Walvoord, notes this. He says, in the ruins of Nebuchadnezzar's palace, archaeologists have uncovered a large throne room 56 feet wide and 173 feet long, which probably was the scene of this banquet. Midway in the long wall opposite the entrance, there was a niche in front of which the king might well have been seated. Interestingly, the wall behind the niche was covered with white plaster, as described by Daniel, which would make an excellent background for such a writing. Interesting observation. Again, archaeology substantiates scripture. Not surprising, of course, this would fit very well with what we read in Daniel chapter 5. It makes it even more vivid. This also was associated with great fear or intense fear and impending doom. The picture of the king's response is of uncontrolled terror. You would think that would get your attention. It would get mine. I'm just looking to see if there's any handwriting on the wall anywhere. But there were both internal and external indications of this great fear, this incredible dread that he's experiencing. He was apparently sober enough to recognize the seriousness of the situation, and he was not just dreaming it. The interesting thing here is, remember Nebuchadnezzar, he was the only one that saw the dream. This everybody saw, a very visible phenomenon. Very, very different. And we may wonder why this event was so different. What was it about this occasion that he made it visible to everyone present? Is it because everyone else was participating in it? Because it was a judgment of such significant nature and so immediate? It certainly was a supernatural event that would be unexplainable in any other way. It is interesting to think about. It certainly made an impact. And it's enough of an impact that we still use that phrase today. And I'm certain that it would have ruined the mood of the party. That is one way to put a kibosh on things. It's like the police showing up or something. And then verses 7 through 9, here we read, "The king cried out to bring in the astrologers, the Chaldeans, and the soothsayers. The king spoke, saying to the wise men of Babylon, 'Whoever reads this writing and tells me its interpretation shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around his neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom.' Now all the king's wise men came, but they could not read the writing or make known to the king its interpretation. Then King Belshazzar was greatly troubled. His countenance was changed, and his lords were astonished." That certainly is an indication of a disruptive situation. The impact of human limitations. It seems that no one who was present understood the writing. You would think with that many people, somebody would be there who would be able to look at it and say, "Well, yeah, I can tell you what that is." But this was not the case. Apparently, the writing was of a sufficient enigma to elude the discernment of anyone who was present. And the king called on those that were supposed to understand such supernatural omens. He mentions here three of the different groups. There were more, but these at least were the ones that were recognized. And these apparently were not in the gathering, but were near enough that they could be called because they were brought in, so they would not have been of the lords themselves. Then the king offered a significant reward to anyone who could decipher the message on the wall. So there's several different things that are noted here. One is clothing someone in purple that meant to give them royal authority. It's also referenced in Esther 8:15. Then the reference to the gold chain or this necklace would have been symbolic, as well as having some monetary value. And then Belshazzar offered to promote anyone who could interpret this mysterious writing to third ruler of the kingdom. And that was likely because he himself was the second ruler under his father, so the highest thing he could offer would have been the third place. That would make sense. Then the abundance of the king's wise men were unable to read or interpret the writing. Now, it says all, but obviously all weren't there because it's not all-inclusive, including Daniel, but he wasn't there yet, but he would be. So it's a more broad, general statement. All the different groups, et cetera, of the people would have come of those that were called. And the writing appears to be in the Aramaic language. Therefore, it seems that the wise men's difficulty shouldn't have been in understanding or being able to read the writing as much as it would have been understanding the meaning of the words and applying them in that context. But there also could have been a supernatural blindness that was given along with this handwriting so that none of the other people were able to see it, so that it was possible for Daniel to come along and be the one to communicate it, and that could be the case. But all of this put the king and his kingdom in their places. They were rendered helpless. They were completely dependent on someone else, and in this case it was God himself, to provide an understanding of what is communicated here. And obviously there was some concern, not just in what they saw, but in what it meant. But it was apparently enough, even though they didn't understand what it meant yet, it was enough just to see what had just happened in front of them. So The reality is that we're all quite helpless apart from God's provision of truth and guidance and deliverance. And, of course, it left the king quite disturbed and frustrated, and even his lords were astonished. They weren't sure what to make of it, because here they have this king, this one who is trying to make a big impression on everyone, and this writing shows up, and he is helpless to deal with it. Now, obviously, this was very effective in getting the king's attention, and it got everybody else's attention, too. And so we might wonder what it would take to get our leaders' attention today. I'm sure we've wondered that many times. What will God use to get their attention? They are, it seems, as oblivious to the true God as this king was. Can you imagine if this happened today? Imagine there's a press conference, and the president is waxing ineloquently. Yes, I did say that. And there was this handwriting on the wall. What would you immediately assume? It was some slick AV trick. Because we've got the technology to do that. Interesting to think about. What's it going to take to get people's attention in the future? Because we've got all this technological stuff. Isn't it going to take something like a rapture and a tribulation period to get their attention? I think that's what the Bible says. Because it made me wonder, what will God have to do to get people's attention in the future? When they've already seen everything, when we can come up with everything to make things look so real, even though it's not. So interesting to think about. Now, what does it take to get the right person for the job? Well, there are a lot of employers that wonder that. It's an ongoing challenge. But the king was kind of wondering that at the moment when no one was able to answer him. So looking at verses 10 through 11, the queen, because of the words of the king and his lords, came to the banquet hall. So whoever this queen was, she wasn't there. The queen spoke, saying, O king, live forever. Do not let your thoughts trouble you, nor let your countenance change. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is the Spirit of the Holy God. And in the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king. Now, is that kind of redundant, strengthening there? Is it really his father or is it his grandfather? Made him chief of the magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans, and soothsayers. So you've got to think through this. Is this legit? The value of remembering history. Well, we need to consider the identity of the queen in this context. Normally we would assume a reference to the queen would mean that it's Belshazzar's wife. But there are a number of reasons to prefer that she is, in fact, the queen mother in this case. She could even possibly have been the surviving wife of Nebuchadnezzar, but I think that's maybe not the case here. Because Belshazzar's wives are referenced as participating in the banquet. They would have already been there, verse 2. So this woman just enters now, apparently for the first time, because that's what it appears to be. And she spoke more to the king more as a mother than as a wife. And she also spoke as one who had personal acquaintance with Daniel's earlier interpretation. Belshazzar didn't seem to be as aware, as we'll see, of him. But she was. Now, if she was the queen mother, she would have been Belshazzar's mother. And she was the daughter of Nebuchadnezzar. Would she have known who that was? Most likely. So the queen mother in many of the contexts of earlier times would have been a significant figure who would have had some considerable influence in these ancient courts. There are other examples, 1 Kings 15:13, 2 Kings 11:1 to 3, 24:12, and Jeremiah 13:18 also give some insight there. So this woman proceeded to do for Belshazzar what Arioch had done for Nebuchadnezzar, that is to bring Daniel to the king's attention, as it was in 2:25. So this likely was also an act of divine intervention that she came in and communicated this at this time as well. It seemed to be a special occasion for that situation. That would have been a second-class miracle if you're remembering the distinction between first class and second class, utilizing circumstances in a special way for a special occasion. So the queen tried to bring assurance and hope for an answer. So she urged the king not to be troubled. Unfortunately, it was too late. He was already greatly troubled. But she said, don't be troubled. She indicated that she knew someone who could give him the answer that he wanted and needed. She indicated that this man was the spirit of the holy God and light and understanding and wisdom like the gods. She indicated that he was made chief of the wise men, and the reference to his father as Nebuchadnezzar would have been, again, a normal indication of familiar lineage. And that was, again, because there was no term for grandfather, per se, so it would have been your forefather. And that would have been quite logical and normal. Not what we're accustomed to, but nonetheless. When you're dealing with different language, different context, that needs to be taken into account. So from our perspective, this was very timely that the queen showed up at this time and that she knew of Daniel and had this connection, and so it makes sense that this would have been the queen mother, most likely, again, part of God's timing and plan. Continuing on with verse 12, inasmuch as an excellent spirit, knowledge, understanding, interpreting dreams, resolving riddles, and explaining enigmas were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar, now let Daniel be called, and he will give the interpretation. Here we see the value of having a good reputation. It seemed that Daniel had a very good reputation that was remembered and still recognized as valid and ongoing. It hadn't deteriorated, even though much time had passed and Daniel is considerably up in years from the previous occasions. So, as before, Daniel was not accompanying the other wise men whom the king had summoned. And the reason, again, is not particularly clear. It's not stated. But the effect is that it sets Daniel off as unique. He had to be called in for this occasion. And he had to be recognized for what he had to offer based on his previous experience and his character, etc. And some suggest maybe Daniel had left public service by this time but was still available and accessible, though we don't know that for sure. But his reputation continued on and was communicated, in this case probably by his mother, in a timely fashion that was important. And so we could only hope that there are many other people like Daniel in our day, so that when the world is falling apart and having problems and needing somebody to come along and provide answers to the strange things that are going on, that Christians can be among those who are called on because they have a correct understanding of what is real and right and true, and that would be the case for those that know Christ and trust his word, and that would be consistent and comparable to Daniel. There was a lingering confidence that Daniel could provide the needed interpretation. There is this long list of qualities and abilities that Daniel has, which is no small thing. Excellent spirit, knowledge, understanding. He's a very capable person in many areas. He's known for interpreting dreams, for solving riddles, explaining enigmas, because he enjoyed the hand of God upon him, because he was sensitive to God. He had a desire to serve him and to be available, and the Lord was utilizing him in that capacity. So even without asking Daniel, she was promoting him suggesting and assuming that Daniel could provide the needed answer. Interesting. She didn't quick send him a text and say, hey, Daniel, is there a chance you could, you know, give an answer to this new situation that's just come up? So we can see, again, that God was at work, working behind the scenes, working through the circumstances in his time and his way, providing the handwriting at the appropriate time and place, hiding the message from the other wise men, apparently, preparing Daniel to disclose the message at the proper time with the queen, queen mother, communicating his ability and availability. So all of this should bolster our confidence in God's ability to work through the governing circumstances of any nation. Just like this was to be an encouragement for the Jewish people who were in exile in Babylon, it ought to be an encouragement for us. If God can work through those circumstances at that time, is he not still able to do the same thing today? And does he not let things go for a significant amount of time before he brings judgment? And that seems to be the way it works. So should we be afraid today when things look like they're falling apart and we're overwhelmed by all the things that are going on? Or do we stay like Daniel did, consistent, true, faithful, no matter what's going on around us, even when the government, when the society, when the culture is going down the tubes? What does it take to get a desired response? Verse 13 says, then Daniel was brought in before the king. The king spoke and said to Daniel, are you that Daniel who is one of the captives from Judah whom my father the king brought from Judah? Now here we want to recognize the importance of identification and availability. Daniel had two forms of notable identity. He was a Jewish captive who was given a position of significant responsibility in the nation of Babylon. That was one. But he was also a committed believer in God with great character who provided great service to the king and the people of Babylon. He served faithfully in the capacity that he was called into, in spite of what the circumstances were, and that he probably was not desirous, he had not been anticipating or looking forward to when he was a kid, of growing up and serving the king of Babylon in any capacity. But there he was. But both of these elements of his identity were recognized. The elements of his character and his relation to God, the true God. Now, that would be something that we would want to be recognized for as well, that we are rightly related to the true God. That would be a great thing to have recognized. We live in a world of identity politics, which is not the same kind of identification as was pointed out here, but it's an identity nonetheless. And it too often focuses on the wrong things, very much the wrong things. And we could stand to focus more on, are we rightly related to God? And there are many more in our culture who are not. But those of us who are have an answer and a hope for those who need it. And so instead of trying to provide some quota for some special group, we need to be communicating the hope that the world needs, as Daniel was available to do because he was faithful. And then Daniel was available to serve as needed. Now, most of the time, Daniel was in the background, just doing what he was supposed to be doing. He was brought forward different times, and that wasn't what he was necessarily looking for. He tended to stay out of the limelight. He was not looking for problems to solve. He was not out to be a hero, but he ended up being one often because of his faithfulness, his consistency of following the Lord, serving him no matter what the circumstances were around them. That's an example that we do well to emulate. He did all of this in a hostile, difficult environment. And as we see our society moving more in that same direction, we do well to look at Daniel as an example that we can follow and one that we could emulate as one who stands for truth and is available to serve the Lord because we're consistently faithful to him. And so we need to be a truth and a light bearer as he was. And then looking at verses 14 through 16, he says, I have heard of you that the Spirit of God is in you, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom are found in you. Now the wise men, the astrologers, have been brought in before me that they should read this writing and make known to me its interpretation, but they could not give the interpretation of the thing. And I have heard of you that you can give interpretations and explain enigmas. Now, if you can read the writing and make known to me its interpretation, you shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around your neck and shall be the third ruler of the kingdom. And then Daniel says, yeah, that sounds great. You got a deal. Or did he kind of blow that off and say, who cares? Not only that, if Daniel knew what was coming, since he could read what was coming, he could already say, you can't give me that anyway. You're not going to last the night. The importance of reputation and resources. Daniel is recognized in terms of his repeated reputation. His reputation had been repeated from the queen mother to the current king, and he stated it again in the presence of Daniel. And he's recognized to have the Spirit of God in him and light and understanding and wisdom. And these are all virtues that are based on being rightly related to God. And that's really the important thing that we want to recognize. And seeing God as the creator, sustainer of the universe, putting things in perspective, seeing the world in the right way, having an accurate understanding of what is real and true and right. And then Daniel is recognized in stark contrast with the other wise men who were not able to provide answers because they were not rightly related to the God of the universe. And so these items are promised to Daniel, which I'm pretty sure didn't mean anything to him because he had a glimpse of what was coming anyways. We'll see. So now Daniel's called on to explain this unknown writing on the wall, and he's able to do so because of the Spirit of God upon him, being rightly related to him because of his personal belief in him. Now we have the same Spirit of God dwelling in us in a way that even Daniel didn't have. We have the indwelling presence of the Holy Spirit. In those Old Testament days, the Spirit would come upon people, but we have the indwelling of the Holy Spirit, which is made clear in the New Testament. So we have the wherewithal to deal with the challenges of life as well. Now, Belshazzar was in the unenviable position of being called to judgment for his deeds and his attitudes, the things that he had done that blatantly showed disregard for God and essentially shaking his fist at him by utilizing those items in this feast. And so God got his attention. So we have a message for the world. And we have a challenge of trying to get the world's attention as well. We're currently looked down on, those who are evangelical Christians, as essentially the scum of the earth because we won't get with the program. We have an allegiance to someone above the powers that be in our world, and that is unacceptable. And so we are viewed as essentially out of step with society. We are the enemy of society because we are resistant to the freedoms that they wish to express, except they are taking away the true freedoms and looking for another kind of freedom, which is anything but. Interesting to think about. So how can we get their attention enough to tell them the message that they need to hear? That's an ongoing challenge. But what we need to be is biblically consistent. We need to be committed to truth. We need to be faithful to Christ. We need to have love for one another and for the lost. And we need to be focused on Him, on the Lord. And so our responsibility is faithfulness. And then God can use that to get people's attention. It worked for Daniel. He was just consistently faithful. And the question for us is, does God need to get our attention first? Are we paying attention to what's going on in the world today? Or does He need to get our attention too? Hopefully, He has our attention.